Silence looked at Morrell.
Don't look at me, Captain. I haven't got a clue what's going on. If there was a big enough rock around, I think I'd try and hide under it. He's not an illusion. He's quite real. But that's all I can tell you. His mind is closed to me. And if he is who he says, I think I'm rather glad about that. Try and make mental contact with the Son of God, and my brains would probably start leaking out my ears. Am I babbling? It sounds like I'm babbling.
He looks just like I always thought he would.
Before anyone starts falling to their knees and shouting hosannas, allow me to point out that there is an alternative explanation. We know that one man survived the base explosion, the scientist Marlowe, who infected himself with nanos programmed for open-ended evolution. This must be him.
And the angels?
I'm still working on that.
Morrell studied the huge forms floating overhead.
You know, I hate to be a stickler for details, but shouldn't they be playing harps or something? And how come they don't have to flap their wings to stay up there?
They certainly don't seem to be aerodynamically stable.
Let's try and stick to the matter at hand. Silence turned his best intimidating glare on Jesus. Are you, in fact, the scientist Marlowe?
That was long, long ago. Behold, I will tell you everything. Once I was just a man as any other. I walked among them, and they did not know my greatness. We were all scientists here, laboring for our emperor. We were researching into nanotech, into God's building blocks, into the transformation and programming of humans. The Emperor wished to be able to determine the shape, nature, and identity of all humans from birth. Properly programmed nanotech should be capable of producing desired traits to order. The population would then consist of pre-programmed worker drones, warriors, breeders, scientists, etc., as needed. Humanity would become efficient, predictable, controlled.
Jesus!
Yes?
They were planning to turn the vast majority of the human species into unpeople, even less than clones and espers. Could they really have done it?
Theoretically, yes. No wonder Lionstone tried to start it up again on Vorginai 4.
I suppose the plan was for the Emperor and a few selected families to be the only true living humans, with everyone else programmed from birth to serve them faithfully all their days. There would never have been any rebellion. The population quite literally wouldn't have been able to conceive of the idea. If they could have made it work, we'd have become ants, insects serving the hive. But Marlowe stopped them. Hell, maybe he is our savior after all.
I don't think so. He was just a man who couldn't wait. He had to try it out on himself first, to see if nanotech could be programmed to make him more than human, a superhuman.
And if you raise humanity to the highest point through endless evolutions, you get a god. Or at least, the Son of God.
I am getting a really bad headache just thinking about the implications of all this. Let's try focusing on some of our more immediate problems. Jesus, do you know anything about the crews of the Shub and Haydenman's ships orbiting this planet?
Of course. I know everything. The creatures of flesh and metal, and the machines that thought they thought. They both came here looking for power, but none of them could cope with what they found. Their minds were too small, too limited, too inflexible. And so they all died. It was very sad. Would you like to speak with them?
The landing party took it in turns to look at each other. Would that be possible?
All things are possible here, in this best of all possible worlds. Behold, I will raise them from the dust for you.
He gestured with one graceful, nail-pierced hand, and the ground before him trembled. It split jaggedly apart, a deep crevice opening up, and from the depths rose a Fury and two Haydenmen. They hung for a moment above the gap, held supported in the air by Jesus' will, and then the ground snapped together again under their feet. The Fury was bare of its usual flesh covering, its steel gleaming blue in the bright sunlight. The two Haydenmen stood inhumanly still, their eyes glowing golden, their faces utterly blank. The three figures seemed solid and real, but somehow empty, like great toys waiting for their instructions. Silence decided he'd start with the Fury. A machine's perception of this unnatural world might provide useful new insights.
You came here from Shub. Tell us what happened.
Illogical. Illusions. Madness. We were called by a voice whose orders could not be denied. We came down to this world, and nothing made sense. Logic does not function here. It became necessary for Shub to break contact with us, to avoid contamination. We were left here, abandoned.
We are very happy here. We preached the perfectibility of man, and we have found it here. We all came down to spend our lives singing praises and hosannas to our Lord, as is fit and proper. He is the most perfect. We have come at last to the promised land.
These are my children, in whom I am well pleased.
He gestured again, and the three figures trembled, as though disturbed by an unfelt breeze, and then they crumbled and fell apart. Carrion moved in close beside Silence.
Don't look now, but the angels are gone too, vanished. I think Jesus just forgot about them.
Dust to dust. From dust they came, and to dust I send them back. They came as you did, seeking wonders, but they were not worthy of the miracles to be found here. Their small minds could not encompass the marvels I have worked in this place. I can call up all who have died here that you may question them if you wish. Be not troubled in your minds and in your hearts. If any of you are troubled, come to me and let me but touch you, and you shall be healed forever.
No one is to lower their shields. That's an order. Moral, did you pick up anything from those returnees?
Not from them, just this low background buzz. But I think I detected some kind of transmission from Jesus. It's possible he could be the puppet master here, speaking his words through their mouths.
Or maybe they just belong to him, because they died here. His forever to do with as he pleased.
Would that make this a heaven or a hell? Singing praises to the Lord for all eternity because you have to.
He has made no direct threat to us as of yet.
Yes, but a lot of that old-time religion is starting to get on my nerves. If he says, behold, one more time...
Oh, a disbeliever. Woe to them who will not see the light. Be careful you do not raise my righteous anger. I have made a heaven here, and I will not be mocked.
You infected yourself with pre-programmed nanotech, and then you took it outside the base and allowed it to transform this entire world. What happened to the original ecosystem? To all the millions of small interacting species that made their home here?
Gone. All gone. They were not important. They have been replaced by something greater. I could summon them up again out of the dust, but what would be the point? Their time was over. Their only reason for existence was to be the place that I would come to. This is my world, my heaven, my paradise, and all things here are as I wish it.
You talk to him, Captain. Perhaps you can find some common ground. This man destroyed a world even more thoroughly than you did.
Life is life. From dust to dust, nothing is ever lost as long as I remember it. Forget them. I am here, your Redeemer. Be happy here and worship me all your days.
You know, we've stumbled across something even more important than we thought. Forget the programming of people. Using the right nanotech, you could pre-program an entire planet in a way that makes terraforming look small and inefficient. It would be the ultimate weapon. Just find a planet you didn't like, sprinkle a few nanos from orbit, and the whole world and its people would become what you wanted.
If we knew how to control it, which we don't. Besides, we came here looking for a possible cure to the nanoplague. Let's not get distracted, people.
Take me from this world on your ship, and I will stop all wars and bring peace everywhere. Cure all ills with my touch. No one now alive need ever die. I will bring about the golden age of which humanity has always dreamed.
It's clear from the limited use they've put it to that Shub is only the barest control of the nanotech they've been using. What we've got here is far more dangerous. It's possible we might be able to create nanos to combat the plague, but as the captain says, we have no experience in controlling it. We have to consider this carefully, Captain. If we let the genie out of this bottle, it might well defeat our enemies. But what about afterwards? Remember what the original Emperor wanted to do with it. And you can see what it did to Marlowe's state of mind.
The sky darkened, and suddenly it was twilight. The air was bitter cold, and Jesus wasn't smiling anymore.
Can we all be a little more careful about how we choose our words around this guy? He may or may not be who he says he is, but he's certainly the god of this world. Our force shields might be strong enough to protect us if he starts calling down the lightning, but hey, let's not put it to the test until we absolutely have to, all right?
You dare to doubt me?
Blood ran freely from the stigmata in Jesus' hands and feet, and from the spear wound in his side.
Let me show you what I can do. You each came here looking for someone, even if you didn't realize it. I can see their names and faces in your minds, and the holes their loss has left in your lives and in your souls. Behold, let the dead rise and walk again!
A swirl of dust rose from the ground, forming a huge whirling dust bowl. The green grasses and blue skies were gone now, sucked up into the flying dust storm. And then part of it took shape and form as a human being. A young man in fleet uniform, who stood before the landing party, smiling. He seemed vaguely familiar to Silence, but it wasn't until Baron lurched suddenly forward that Silence realized who he was looking at.
Father!
And Baron stumbled toward the smiling figure. Silence started after him, and then held his ground. He didn't want to get too close to the new figure, or to Jesus.
Baron, this isn't your father. He died on Ancili. This is just a ghost made of nanotech.
Do you think I don't know my own father? He's exactly how he looks in the old family hollows.
Of course he looks like that. He must be drawing on your memories to shape the nanos.
Does it really matter?
Silence felt a cold hand clutch at his heart. He turned slowly, and there was Investigator Frost, looking just as he remembered her, before she died.
You can't be real. You're just my memories, given shape and form. Aren't you?
Good question. Damned if I know the answer. I feel real enough, but then I would say that, wouldn't I? Come with me. There are things we need to discuss.
And Captain Silence and Investigator Frost walked slowly off together, so taken up with each other's presence that they didn't even notice the world reforming itself around them. The whirling dust bowl became a green forest for them, and soon they were walking between tall, proud trees, while something very like birds sang sweetly overhead. The air was full of the scents of autumn, and dry grasses and fallen leaves crunched under their boots. Silence recognized the place. They were walking through a forest on Viramond, in a place where he had nearly died. It seemed such a long time ago now.
So, how have you been? Not wasting time mourning me, I hope.
I've been getting on with my life, keeping busy. A lot's happened since you died.
More wars, I suppose. There's always a war going on somewhere. Did Lionstone live long enough to stand trial? I would have liked to see that.
She escaped, in spirit at least. Joined her mind with the AIs of Shub, leaving her body behind. Kid Death destroyed it, just in case.
Ah, yes. The Summer Isle. I remember him. He killed me. Did you kill him?
No. It seemed to me there'd been enough killing. Besides, he would never have surrendered to the Rebellion. That's why you let him kill you. It's no surprise to me that my mind chose this place for us to talk. I nearly died here when Stelmach shot me. But I used my abilities to heal a wound that would have killed anyone else. You had the same abilities. You could have healed yourself if you'd wanted to. But you wanted to die.
Yes, I did. I'm glad you finally admitted that to yourself. Don't feel guilty over my death, John. It was inevitable. There was no place for me in the new order that was coming.
Did you ever love me?
I was an investigator, John. What do you think?
By now, Micah Baron and his father Rickard were riding horses over the shifting scarlet sands of their homeworld, Tau City 3. The sky was a shade of green that most outworlders described as sickly, and the ever-present drifting clouds were jet black, shot within by sudden golden lightning storms. Just another day on Tau City 3. Micah and Rickard were following a long-established trail and didn't even need to guide their mounts. The horses knew the way. That gave father and son all the more time to talk together, but they were finding the going hard. Father and son talks have always been tricky, difficult things, especially when son and father are pretty much the same age, and the father has been dead for years.
I joined the fleet to follow you, Dad. To go where you'd gone, to see the things you'd seen. I thought it would help me feel closer to you.
I know I was never home much. They promised us a lot of accumulated leave when we got back from Unseelie, but... well, I gather a lot of us never came home from Unseelie.
The Ashrai are dead. Captain Silence made them pay for what they did to you, to all of you. He scorched the planet, wiped them all out.
Is that supposed to make me feel better, son? I hated the Ashrai while I was fighting them. But time and being dead gives you perspective. It was their planet. Of course they fought. I would have, to defend Tau City 3 from invaders. Tell me you didn't just join up to kill aliens, son.
Not really. Mostly, I just wanted to get off Tau City 3. I mean, I know it's home, but it was small and limited.
Boring.
Right! I wanted to see the Empire. Other worlds, other people. I requested transfer to Captain Silence's command so I could follow in your footsteps. You'd always spoken well of him in your messages home. Turned out to be pretty easy getting a place on his ship. He's not been the most popular captain in the fleet for some time.
Trust me, Micah. He never was. Silence was good to his crew, but no good at politics. Anyone else with his abilities and record would have been an admiral by now. But he never was any good at kissing the right asses. Most of us respected him for that. You always knew where you were with Silence. How's your mother these days?
All right, I suppose. I haven't heard from her in a while. I probably owe her a letter.
Write to your mother. Better still, save up and send her a personal holo.
You're a fine one to talk.
Learn from my mistakes, son. That's what fathers are for.
They rode on a while in silence, moving easily to the rhythm of the horses beneath them.
I never meant to die on Unseelie, you know. I always meant to come home to your mother and to you. Don't think I went off and deserted you.
I never thought that.
Really? Not ever?
Well, maybe sometimes. When I was young, I wondered if I'd done something wrong, and that was why you never came home. But I got over it.
Did you? Then why are you serving in the fleet, trying to recreate my life? I never expected you to sign up. I expected you to strike out on your own and make your own life. Not just copy me.
I just wanted you to be proud of me, Dad.
Oh, Micah. Of course I'm proud of you. You're my son.
They rode on across the shifting scarlet sands, and for a while, they didn't need to say anything at all. Carrion stood in the middle of the metallic forest on Unseelie, before Shub came and harvested the trees, before the Empire came and exterminated the Ashrai. The huge metal trees soared up high into the sky, branches radiating out from the smooth, featureless trunks in needle-sharp spikes dozens of feet long. Gold and silver and brass, violet and azure, standing firm and unyielding against the planet's never-ending storms. And all through the metal trees, the Ashrai, alive and glorious, they soared in the skies like ancient dragons, vast and powerful. And down below, Carrion smiled and smiled, his eyes wet with unshed tears, back home and at peace again. Captain Silence looked around him, at the green and peaceful forest bathed in the autumn sunlight.
This isn't real. None of this is real. Viramond is light years from here. But it looks just the way I remember.
Of course it does. Marlowe took the images from your mind and had his nanos recreate them for you. Same way he produced me.
Silence reached out with his mind, trying to reestablish the old mental link he and Frost had once shared, but it was like looking into a mirror, with only his own face looking back at him.
Sorry, but I'm not real either. Just a memory given shape and form by nanotech and a madman's power. I'm just real enough not to want to be used as a weapon against you. Come on, Captain. You really only needed to say goodbye properly, and we've done that. It's time to let me go and get back to dealing with Marlowe. He may think he's the son of God, but he's actually quite limited in what he can do.
There was so much I wanted to say to you.
Then you should have said it while I was still alive. I probably knew it all anyway. Goodbye, John.
She walked away into the forest, and Silence stood and watched her go, knowing he'd never see her again.
I don't believe in you. None of this is real. I deny you. Damn you, Marlowe, stop this. Damn your soul to hell, stop this right now.
Something moved within him as his own power stirred reluctantly from its rest, uncoiling and reaching out in strange directions. And one by one, the trees began to crumble and fall apart into dust, and then less than dust. Micah Baron reined in his horse and dismounted. A low wind was blowing, sending the red sands dancing this way and that. His father dismounted too, and the two young men stood facing each other for a long moment. They looked more like brothers than father and son.
I think we've gone as far as we're going, and we've said all we needed to say.
Yes. Time to say goodbye. Any last thing I can do for you, son?
Yes. Hug me, as a father hugs his son. Because I don't remember that at all.
You know what you're asking, Micah. What you'll have to do.
Oh, yes. I'll have to drop my force shield and let you in. But that's what I want, Father. What I've always wanted. So we'll never be apart again.
He keyed the right combination into the control pad at his waist, and the shimmering force shield around him snapped out in a moment. Rickard stepped forward and took his son in his arms. They held each other, and the nanos went to work. The two forms merged, and Micah Baron finally became what he most wanted to become, his father. Silence walked out of the disappearing forest of Viramond and suddenly found himself walking among the metallic trees of Unseelie. He didn't need to ask whose dream he was walking through now. He paused a moment to look at the Ashrai flying overhead and tried to feel guilty, but it was all so long ago. Still, it had been a long time since he'd seen them in flight. They were marvelous. He found Carrion easily enough. Marlowe or Jesus or whatever the hell he was now hadn't bothered to recreate much of the metallic forest. Silence walked quickly through it, and there Carrion was, sitting peacefully in full lotus, with his back against the smooth trunk of a golden tree, his eyes closed. Silence had never seen him look so happy, even if he was still wearing his traitor's black.
Sean, time to wake up. Time to go.
Carrion refused to open his eyes, as though denying Silence's presence.
Go away, John. You have no place here. You don't belong here. I have come home, and everything's all right again.
Nothing's right. This isn't real. It's just a nanotech recreation.
Do you think I don't know that? I know this isn't real, and I don't care. I have found peace and heart's content that I never thought to know again. I will stay here.
And you'll die.
Yes, John. That's what I want, really. What I've always wanted. Don't you know that?
Silence knelt down beside him.
I need you, Sean.
You always need someone. You used that argument to drag me away from peace last time. Made me live again when all I wanted was to die. Leave me alone.
Please, Sean, don't do this. You're my friend. I lost Frost. I don't want to lose you too. There was a moment that seemed to last forever. And then Carrion opened his eyes.
You always did know how to fight dirty, John. But I don't think even you can pull me out of this grave I've dug for myself. This is a place of the dead, and I belong here.
God, you're a gloomy bastard. Ask the Ashrai. Ask the ghosts that insist on haunting you. See what they think of this show. This mockery.
Now, that should be interesting.
He opened his mouth and let out an alien sound, the eerie cry of the Ashrai. And in a moment, as though they had only been waiting to be summoned, the real Ashrai were there with him, huge and brutal presences that had only contempt for this recreation of everything they had lost. They tore through the fake metallic forest like a living storm and reduced it to shreds. The metal trees burst apart, and the jagged gleaming shards and fragments were pulled up into a great maelstrom of howling gargoyle faces. The fake Ashrai disappeared in a moment, unable to withstand the furious presence of the real thing, like shadows dispersed by a blinding light. Silence and Carrion huddled together as the storm raged about them, but somehow never quite touched them. The song of the dead Ashrai was a powerful, awful thing, and the will of the man once called Marlow could not stand against it. The dream of a vanished forest was blown apart and carried away on an all-too-real wind. And soon, there was nothing left but the whirling dust from which it had sprung. Silence and Carrion found they were standing before Jesus again. He looked seriously angry.
I make a heaven for you and you spit in my face? Must man always walk away from paradise?
Every dream has to end sometime. Even yours, Marlow.
Don't call me that! That man is dead. You can have no comprehension of what I've become.
Jesus had lost his halo, and his crown of thorns had caught fire. Flames danced on his brow and in his eyes.
Oh, you'd be surprised. Carrion and I have both known the touch of a greater force in our time. We just never lost our sense of proportion. Marlow, what was your dream like?
Never had one. The moment he came fumbling round my mind, I put up the toughest mental shield I could fashion. He didn't even come close to cracking it. He may command the nanotech, but as a telepath, he's strictly low level. I have to say, this guy is a real letdown. The nanos gave him control over an entire planet, and all he does is play childish games. He hasn't even touched his real potential.
Hold everything. Where's Baron?
They looked around, but he was nowhere to be seen. There were only the three of them, and Jesus, and the whirling dust storm. Jesus was smiling again. Silence glared at him.
What have you done with Baron, Marlow?
He gave in to his dream. In the end, he was just a lost child who only wanted to be the man his father was. And now he is. He belongs to me. And soon you will, too. Since you won't accept my heaven, I condemn you to hell.
Flames leapt up everywhere, replacing the dust storm. The landing party flinched back from the heat, even though it couldn't touch them through their shields. The sky was dark, lit by lightning, and clawed and fanged demons soared overhead on huge bat wings. The screams seemed to come from everywhere. Silence and Carrion and Morrow moved close together.
Damn! He's got past my shields.
Either he's getting stronger, or he's getting more determined.
This isn't real. Don't believe in it.
It's as real as a nano's can make it. This vision comes from Marlow's mind, not ours. Disbelieving in it won't make it disappear. Not when he's obviously enjoying himself so much.
They looked at Marlow, and where Jesus had been, now stood the devil, with scarlet skin, cloven feet, and a goat's head with curling horns. It was more like a child's picture than a detailed creation, but it made Marlow's state of mind clear enough. The thick lips leered.
I'm tired of being the Prince of Peace. I think this will be much more fun. I'll just hold you here till your shields go down. And then you'll be mine to make and remake as the whim takes me. I'll stir my sticky fingers in your flesh and mold you into your worst nightmares. You'll be my playthings forever and ever and ever.
He can do it. I can't break his hold on my mind. Oh God, Captain, do something.
Gary, call the Ashrine. See if they're still angry.
Oh, they're already here.
Huge forms came plunging down from above, gargoyle faces roaring their rage in a sound almost too loud to be borne. The devil snarled and threw demons at them with a wave of a clawed crimson hand. The huge forms slammed together, filling the dark sky. More and more demons formed out of nothing, created by Marlowe's nanos. Silence and Carrion looked at each other. Almost against their will, their altered minds reached out to each other and came together. Morrel had to look away, hiding behind his strongest shields for fear of being blinded by the light their fusion was generating. Silence and Carrion struck out at the devil, and it was only the work of a moment for their more powerful will to snatch control of the nanos away from Marlowe. He really wasn't much of a telepath, and he'd been alone so long, with no one to challenge his will. Hell flickered out and was gone, like a blown-out candle. Silence, Carrion, and Morrel stood on a bare rock plain, facing a man already crumbling and falling apart. Only the nanos had kept him alive, and now they were deserting his body, like rats leaving a sinking ship. He became dust and less than dust, and blew away on a gusting wind. Above, the sky was clear of Ashrai and demons. Silence and Carrion looked away from each other, embarrassed by the enforced intimacy of their sharing. They could have retained control of the nanos, but chose not to. They had come far enough from humanity as it was. They had enough damnation on their souls already, without adding further temptation.
Well, that was interesting. Can we get the hell out of here now, please, Captain?
We might as well. This mission is a bust. There's nothing here we dare let loose. No one can be trusted with this kind of power. I'd recommend scorching the world from orbit if I thought it would do any good. But the nanos might survive even that. So we leave the genie in the bottle until humanity's evolved into something wise enough to use it correctly.
And we lost Baron. I brought him here. He trusted me. He should have remembered I was always a bird of ill omen.
Silence looked around at the empty rocky plain.
I wonder what the nanos will make of this place, now that they no longer have a human mind to guide or limit them. Might be worth coming back here in a few centuries, just to see what kind of world the nanos make.
He put in a call to the pinnace waiting in orbit, and it came down and hovered above the rocky ground as the landing party took turns to jump awkwardly up into the open airlock. Silence was last off as captain. He took one last look back, and off in the distance, he thought he saw Baron standing alone, waving goodbye. Silence turned his back on 00 and let the pinnace take him back to the Dauntless and his duty. Wedding days are supposed to be important. A man and a woman joining their lives together to love, honor, and worship each other's body till their breath runs out or the stars go cold. Weddings are supposed to be days of celebration, of ancient and important oaths freely entered into that will change two lives forever. Till death or divorce do they part. How much more important, then, a wedding between a man and a woman who were that very day to be also crowned king and queen of the empire, constitutional monarchs for billions of men and women on thousands of worlds. Parliament had decided against an emperor and empress. It was felt by all that the old titles suggested too much power. The dual wedding and investiture was going to be the biggest ceremony the Empire had ever seen. The bride and groom got no say in the matter. As always, private romance had to take a back seat to public politics. Golgotha went loudly and ostentatiously crazy as the countdown to the wedding hit the last few hours. Everyone who was anyone would be attending the ceremony in person, and holo coverage would be transmitted live to every planet in the Empire. Street parties choked the thoroughfares, as all but the most essential occupations were shut down for the day as a mark of respect. Everyone wished the couple to be well. Robert Campbell and Constance Wolfe's faces were everywhere, from all the various news media to all kinds of merchandising. Not all of it particularly tasteful or even authorized, but it just showed how everyone wanted to get involved. Presents for the happy couple had been arriving from all over the Empire for months. They were currently being stacked and guarded in three separate warehouses after being carefully checked for bombs or booby traps, because there were always a few spoil sports. The imminent wedding and investiture had pushed all the other news off the holo screens, which was just as well, because all the other news seemed to be uniformly bad. The Shub Armada and the awful vessels of the Recreated were still bearing down on Golgotha. Diana Virtue had gone to meet Shub in the Death Stalker's last standing, but first reports of their confrontation had not been encouraging. Elsewhere in the Empire, Ghost Warriors and Furies, Grendels and Insect Aliens and Haydenmen fought dreadful battles with human armies on hundreds of worlds, and good news was hard to come by. There was no shortage of bravery or great feats of valor, but the odds against humanity were perhaps just too great this time. So, Parliament brought the royal wedding forward by a week. As a distraction for the general populace, it worked fine. People seized on the forthcoming spectacle with a desperate joy, glad of an excuse not to have to think about other things. It helped that Robert and Constance's arranged marriage was also clearly a love match. They obviously adored each other, and it seemed that the whole empire wished them well. No one mentioned Constance's first proposed husband and potential monarch, Owen Deathstalker, still missing and presumed dead. If anyone thought of him at all, it was to curse him for not being around to save humanity when he was needed most. There were a few who muttered about the cost of all these celebrations, or insisted on spoiling the general good mood with cries of doom and imminent destruction, but no one listened, or at least no one who mattered. The people wanted this wedding, this distraction. In fact, they wanted it so much that the ceremony had practically taken on a life and impetus of its own, irrespective of those involved, and would not be denied. The marriage and investiture of the two royals was to be held on the floor of the House of Parliament. It was the only suitably important, prestigious, and historically august site that everyone could agree on. It was 10 o'clock in the morning, a good 4 hours before the ceremony was due to begin, but already the great antechamber leading onto the floor of the house was packed and swarming with people. The huge double doors giving onto the house were still securely locked, but the antechamber was fast filling with invited guests, determined to seize the most advantageous positions. There was no arranged seating or even standing. First through the doors got the best spots from which to watch the wedding. This had become necessary when the first negotiations over seating precedence had led to open rioting. Jostling for position was rife, and only a heavy presence of armed security guards kept the constant arguments and name-calling from degenerating into pushing matches and fistfights. None of the guests were allowed to bring weapons in, of course. So far, the worst incidents had been limited to cutting remarks about who had done what during the rebellion and the occasional headbutting, but the guards had strict orders to eject anyone who even looked like getting out of hand, and no one wanted to risk that. The words high-spirited were used a lot, as relatives quickly hustled bloody noses out of the sight of approaching guards. Of course, the moment any of the many hollow news cameras passed through, everyone was immediately all sweetness and light. No one wanted to be seen to be souring the mood. Everyone who was anyone, or at least those left after all the many crises of recent times, had come to see and be seen, and if at all possible, to be noticed by the new king and queen. From such small beginnings, whole careers and futures could be forged. On the other side of the locked double doors on the floor of the house, the chaos was, if anything, even worse. Bringing everything forward a week had thrown everyone's plans out of joint, and they were all scrabbling heroically to be ready on time. No one wanted to go down in the history books as the one who let down the royal couple. Reputations were on the line here. So the caterers were going crazy in the adjoining kitchens, screaming abuse into their comm units over undelivered goods. The chefs were screaming at the cooks over last-minute changes to the menus, and everyone was shouting at the flustered kitchen staff, who did all the real work, who were taking it in turns to throw hissy fits and slope off to the toilets for a quiet sit-down and a smoke. Cartloads of food arrived every 10 minutes, and then had to wait ages while they were checked inside and out by security. Chefs wept and cooks pleaded for essential items held up in the queue, but security refused to be hurried. One of the official tasters caused near panic by suddenly complaining of chest pains, but it turned out to be just gas. Meanwhile, entire animal carcasses were turning slowly on spits, whole rainforests of vegetation were being sliced and diced and carved into interesting shapes, and serious desserts of appalling sweetness and stickiness were being plotted by serious-looking men in silly hats. Clear soup and cloudy wine stood by in barrels, while hundreds of fish in great tanks looked on nervously. The heat in the kitchens was unbearable, the noise was appalling, and the mingled scents were powerful enough to intoxicate lesser mortals. Alone in the depths of the great freezer, isolated in his pressure suit, the ice sculptor was furiously turning out a series of delicate ice creations and cursing his apprentice for going down with the flu. On the floor of the house, political and social advisors were screaming at each other over points of tradition, precedence, and etiquette, and regularly having to be forcibly separated by the amused security guards. And they hadn't even got to the order of presentation of the more important guests to the newly crowned royal couple yet. The bridesmaids, 24 beautiful young ladies of the highest good character, dressed in acres of frothy pink, had finally rebelled against the endless wedding rehearsals and had retired to a relatively quiet corner to get loudly and ostentatiously drunk. They'd been chosen by lot from among all the suitable young ladies of the clans, and it was supposed to be a great honor for them. Traditionally, the bridesmaids should have come from the bride and groom's families, but since Clan Wolf had pretty much wiped out Clan Campbell in a very hostile takeover not all that long ago, it had been tactfully decided by all concerned to forget that particular tradition. When the bridesmaids had first been selected, they'd been delighted at being part of such an auspicious occasion. But that was before they'd spent days being drilled in close formation to carry out the slow-motion dances, approaches, and withdrawals dictated by the royal ceremony. The young ladies were far more used to giving orders than taking them. They hated being shouted at when they got it wrong, and their feet hurt. But they couldn't back out now, because they knew their families would kill them if they did. But the instructor had criticized their deportment just once too often, and they were now taking comfort in bottles of champagne purloined from the kitchens and trying to chat up the security guards. So far, none of the guards had weakened, or at least, not when an officer was watching. If only because they, like everyone else, knew they were always under the cold, watchful gaze of Chantel, the mistress of ceremonies. Chantel got the job partly because everyone knew she'd be good at it, partly because no one else wanted it, but mostly because no one could say no to her. Chantel had been around for what seemed like ages, not a part of any clan or clique, but nevertheless an essential part of the social scene. She was that particular brand of celebrity, famous for being famous. No party was complete without Chantel, sparkling and laughing and spreading witty confusion wherever she went. Her put-downs and barbed bon mots were legendary. But you were no one until Chantel had deigned to notice you. She was one of those mysterious people who always knew who and what was in and out before anybody else did, and she could be merciless with overconfident arrivistes and insufficiently arrogant artists. But for all her potential venom, she was always the life and soul of every party, and the heartiest chatter and loudest laughter always came from the crowds and gatherings of which she was a part. Scandals followed her like so many dogged shadows, but somehow none of them ever really stuck. She'd had affairs with everyone who mattered, and as a result had influence in high and low places. She'd never married, never had any children that anyone knew about, and her own family background remained a mystery, despite many determined investigations by the hollow chat and gossip shows. Chantel had been heard to boast that she created herself, and many believed it. She was tall and fashionably slender, with long honey gold hair, and her heart-shaped face wore just enough makeup to look like she didn't need any. She was dressed in full-length shimmering gold, bold enough to attract the holo cameras without being blatant enough to distract from the bride. Her eyes were an icy blue, capable of sparkling with mischief one minute and cutting someone dead the next. Her smile was wide, her teeth perfect, and she had a laugh that could start a party all on its own. She was beautiful, graceful, droll, and everyone adored her. if they knew what was good for them. Chantel never forgot a slight and gloried in revenge. She was a star and took it as a personal affront if anyone sought to shine more brightly than she. How fitting, then, that the Queen of Society should be in charge of creating the new Queen of the Empire. And the King, of course. She bustled back and forth across the floor of the house, barking instructions, solving problems and averting crises, and bringing together opposing factions by sheer charm and charisma. Where reason didn't work and charm failed, she settled for simple intimidation. It wasn't wise to get Chantel mad at you. She knew things. Often very embarrassing things. No one could dominate high society for as long as Chantel had and not know something about absolutely everybody. Her diaries were kept in a locked vault under armed guard. In the meantime, she had a plan for the royal wedding and investiture, and by God and all his saints, everyone was going to follow it. She glared the bridesmaids into sullen obedience, sorted out matters of precedence with icy logic, and lowered the noise coming from the kitchens just by poking her head around the door. Chantel in full flight was like a force of nature, not to be diverted or denied by any mere mortals. Unless, of course, you were Adrienne Campbell, a force of nature in her own right, and twice as violent. Adrienne and Chantel had both swept through high society on their own terms, blazing a path through sheer unrelenting force of personality. But whereas Chantel had gloried in her position, Adrienne had been famous for not giving a damn. Chantel dominated her peers. Adrienne never admitted that she had any. The two women had never been friends, though they had shared a number of highly placed lovers, who all had enough sense to keep their mouths firmly shut about certain matters, but they'd never really been rivals either. It had been simpler and safer for them to simply smile in passing and occasionally kiss the air near each other's cheeks and then go their own way. Rather than risk starting a war, neither felt entirely sure about winning. And so things went, with two suns in the firmament and endless orbiting followers, until Clan Campbell was suddenly brought down by Clan Wolf, and the surviving Campbells had to run for their lives. Adrienne had to call in every favor she was owed just to survive, and with her husband Finley a declared outlaw, her position became increasingly precarious. All her old friends deserted her, her enemies sneered openly, and creditors pursued her from one squalid bolt hole to another. As far as society was concerned, Adrienne was out as well as down, and nobody would help her. Chantel went around saying she'd always known Adrienne was trouble, and they were all far better off without her. When Adrienne contacted her anyway to ask for help, driven by desperation, poverty, and fear of what might happen to her two young children, Chantel laughed in her face, gloried in her downfall, and told Adrienne to go straight to hell by the express route. Of course, the wheel always turns, and now Adrienne Campbell was in again, welcomed back into society with open arms, all bad feelings forgotten. Partly because of her social and political links with important rebel leaders, and partly because she was King Robert to be's favorite relation. Aristocrats could be remarkably pragmatic when they had to be. So once again, Adrienne was courted and acclaimed, and welcomed into every salon and private function. Old hurts and turned backs were laughed away, forgotten and forgiven, because in the end, they and Adrienne knew the score. You don't blame sharks for doing what sharks do. But somehow, Adrienne had never forgiven Chantel, because if anyone should have understood and helped her, it was Chantel. Eventually, inevitably, the two women ended up together, face to face. They nodded and smiled, and all around, people began surreptitiously backing away. The two women studied each other, as intent as two gunslingers on an empty street. The security guards looked purposefully in other directions. They weren't being paid nearly enough to deal with Adrienne and Chantel. There wasn't that much money in the Empire. They were there to handle lesser problems, like armed terrorists and alien invasions. They could handle those. The noise in the Great Hall died almost completely away, as everyone watched with bated breath to see what would happen. And then the two women leaned forward and embraced each other with fixed, unwavering smiles. Peace, of a sort, had been declared. The noise level gradually resumed its normal din as everyone went back to panicking, shouting, and running around in ever-decreasing circles.
So, all is forgiven? Friends again?
We were never friends, and we're not now. I just don't want anything to spoil Robert and Constance's big day. But afterwards, all gloves are off. I will see you utterly destroyed, Chantel, including your reputation, your fading looks, and all your finances down to the very last penny. I'll see you crawl in the dirt and beg for drink, and I won't even lower myself to piss on you.
You always did take things too personally. I just go with the flow, darling. You were in, then you were out, and now you're in again. That's how things go in society. One day, even I may fall from grace, for a time, and then it'll be your turn to crow. It's a question of style, you see. But then you and style have never been friends, have you? I mean, that silver dress you're wearing is so déclassé, and you really should find the money for a new nose. Now then, I have work to do. Busy, busy, busy. Shouldn't you be holding Robert's hand or something? I'm told the poor dear is in a very nervous condition. Hardly surprising after what happened at his last wedding.
He can manage without me for a few minutes. I thought it important we have this little chat.
You can't touch me, Adrian. I have friends.
No, you don't. I'd wager good money you've never had a friend in your life. At best, you have allies. And I'm going to take them all away from you.
Dream on, darling. Recent rebel heroes might be in at the moment, but heroes and politics come and go while the old powers remain. Don't bank too hard on your relationship to the new king. All kinds of things may change once he discovers the true political realities of his situation. Now, you must excuse me. I have a lot of people to shout at, and I'm behind in my schedule. I was sorry to hear about Finlay.
But not sorry enough to go to his funeral.
Oh, I detest funerals, darling. They're depressing. Those frightful family dues afterwards. And besides, black was never my colour. But I do miss Finlay.
Oh, you know very well you couldn't stand him.
Not for long, true. His conversation was very limited. But he made a perfectly adequate lover for a while.
And with that final devastating sally, Chantel bestowed a last perfect smile on Adrienne and went on about her business. Not that far away, Toby Schreck and his cameraman Flynn had been getting it all on film. They were both wise enough not to broadcast it live, but you never knew when footage like that might come in handy. Normally, both ladies would have detected a camera's presence through sheer instinct, but they were so taken up with each other they'd completely missed Flynn's camera hovering silently just behind a waiter's shoulder. The picture might be somewhat limited, but there'd be nothing wrong with the audio. Flynn grinned as the camera flew back to perch on his shoulder again.
Recriminations, threats, and sheer bloody mindedness, and the day's barely started. God knows what we'll have recorded by the end of the day.
We probably won't be able to use most of it, if we want to keep our dangly parts where they're supposed to be. But just the threat of owning footage like that should be enough to pry some useful quotes out of those two later on. As confrontations go, I was hoping for something a little more dramatic, involving raised voices and a certain amount of open violence, but that little tidbit about the late Finlay Campbell would do very nicely as future leverage.
You have no ethics at all, do you, boss?
Of course not. I'm an award-winning journalist. Now, let's see if we can find someone else to sneak up on.
A pair of elves began wandering purposefully in their direction, and Toby and Flynn immediately decided to make themselves hard to find for a while. The elf espers had been brought in from New Hope to provide top-level security under their current representative, Crow Jane. The Gestalt telepaths had a lot of experience as battle espers, and a complete willingness to kick anyone's ass if he looked like he needed it. Permanently in telepathic contact with each other, armed to the teeth, and possessed of powers that unnerved even standard espers, they made perfect security guards. They also made sure that everyone was exactly who he or she was supposed to be. The Mater Mundi Gestalt had provided living S-blockers, who strolled quietly through the crowds inside and out, ensuring that no one but the security elves could use any form of Esp. Now that all espers were part of a single conscious Gestalt, the threat of rogue espers was pretty much eliminated, but no one was taking any chances. Crow Jane strode restlessly back and forth, checking everything over and over again, down to the smallest detail. A tall, strapping brunette in chains and leathers With colors on her face and ribbons tied in her hair, she wore a bandolier of throwing stars across an impressive bosom and a scowl that could shatter steel at 20 paces. Wherever she walked, people hurried to get out of her way. She had made up her mind that the wedding and investiture were going to be absolutely perfect, and God help anyone who got in the way of that. It helped that Crow Jane took no shit from anyone, whether it be the highest members of society or the lowliest flunky. Even Chantel found pressing reasons to be somewhere else very quickly when Crow Jane was on the prowl. She was currently responding to a number of complaints and not a few hand-wringing pleas to do something about the choir. These hand-picked young vocalists, chosen for the purity of their voices, were currently running amok and causing more sheer havoc than a Grendel with hemorrhoids. The choristers might look like little angels in their frilly, starched surplices and delicate ruffs, but secure in their own importance, they had seized the chance to behave like little devils. To be fair, the oldest of them was only 11, and though they'd all had the solemnity and importance of the occasion drilled into them, it had only taken about 10 minutes exposure to the total chaos to plunge them straight into overexcitement and out the other side into sheer let's-see-what-we-can-get-away-with mode. They ran back and forth like little windmilling dervishes, shrieking and name-calling and getting under everyone's feet, and sneaking into the kitchens faster than they could be thrown out. Two had developed a quite remarkable skill as pickpockets, two more had started a dice school and were challenging all comers, and another was being sick over a potted plant through sheer excitement. One little cherub had smuggled in a paint stick and was industriously covering a low level of one wall with fortunately incomprehensible graffiti, while behind him, another chorister was taking advantage of his absorption to set fire to the back of his surplice. The choirmaster ran back and forth, ignored by all. And then Crow Jane arrived. The choir boys took one look at her, knew real trouble when they saw it, and tried to scatter in all directions, but somehow there was always an elf in just the right place to grab them. Crow Jane retrieved a handful of wallets and other valuable items and returned them to their startled owners, confiscated the paint stick, and emptied a bottle of the cheaper wine over the smoldering surplus. She then had a short but vehement heart-to-heart with the assembled choir before sending them off to an adjoining private room to wait till they were called. No one else caught what she had to say, but no one had ever seen the color drop out of so many faces simultaneously. When Crow Jane finally let them go, they headed immediately for the private room, huddling together for protection, followed by a relieved but equally shaken choir master, who made the sign of the cross at Crow Jane's back when he thought she wasn't looking. And standing well back from all the turmoil and din, watching everything with a calm, cold gaze, was the priest chosen to perform the wedding, Cardinal Brendan. Neither Robert nor Constance had wanted such an openly political creature in charge of their wedding, but their own preferred choice, Saint Beatrice, had politely declined to leave her mission on Lacrimae Christi, where she felt she was needed more. Everyone else involved in planning the ceremony heaved quiet but heartfelt sighs of relief. Saint Bee was beloved by all, but no one would have felt comfortable coming into close contact with someone who voluntarily lived among lepers. Saints should keep their distance. All kinds of clerics were suggested by all sorts of religious and political factions for all kinds of reasons, but in the end, Cardinal Brendan emerged as the chosen candidate. He was well known and well liked, and more importantly, he was Blue Block. And as in so many things, what Blue Block wanted, Blue Block got. Brendan himself didn't give a damn about the forthcoming ceremony. He knew that the real business of the day was to be concluded before the wedding or the investiture, right here, in a private room off the floor of the house, where he could quietly explain the real facts of life to Robert, and if need be, Constance. That just having a crown placed on your head meant nothing where Blue Block was concerned. King and Queen would bow down to Blue Block, or else. Brendan smiled at the thought. He'd already had one little chat with Robert, but apparently that hadn't taken as strongly as he would have liked. So this time he was calling in the heavy artillery, and either Robert submitted to what they had planned for him, or there would be no wedding. Brendan moved unhurriedly through the crowd, bestowing smiles and blessings as he passed, untouched by the general riot, until he reached his chosen partner in crime. Chantel was talking earnestly with Donna Silvestri, a broad, motherly figure and one of the Empire's more subtle movers and shakers. The Silvestri had risen to prominence in her clan by the usual methods of treachery and murder, but always in such carefully planned ways that no blame could ever be traced to her. Now people jumped to obey her every murmured word, inside and outside her family. She had a gift for intrigue, and enough quiet malevolence to ensure that her will always took precedence over others. She ran things from the shadows and liked it that way. She was, of course, Blue Block. In person, Donna Silvestri looked like everybody's favorite aunt, round and broad and always a few years out of fashion. She had an ear for every problem and a shoulder for everyone who needed one. And if her warm smile never entirely reached her faded blue eyes, people were usually too preoccupied to notice. Donna Silvestri listened patiently, made all the right supportive noises, and forgot nothing. She stored everything away in her rat trap of a mind until some muttered confidence might prove useful, at which time some poor fool would suddenly find Blue Block knew the one thing he would have sworn nobody knew. Nobody ever suspected the warm and kind and comforting Donna Silvestri. Suspecting her would have been like condemning your own mother. Cardinal Brendan bowed to Donna Silvestri and Chantel, and they both nodded politely in return.
Sorry to bother you, but I need a word in private, Chantel. A minor problem concerning royal etiquette.
Of course. We can use one of the private rooms. No one will disturb us there.
Chantel led the way, and Brendan followed demurely after her. There were a number of small private rooms leading off the main hall of the house, where by long tradition, deals and discussions could be had in complete privacy. The rooms were soundproofed, guaranteed unbugged, had no windows, and only one door, with a first-class lock. More of the really important debates took place in these small rooms than ever occurred in the house itself. Real politics was too important to be practiced in public. Some of the rooms were already in use, as politicians and aristocrats fought out their new pecking order in the face of a constitutional monarchy. Everyone had his or her own plans for the future king and queen. Even in the face of utter destruction by so many of humanity's enemies, Golgotha concentrated on what was truly important. Chantel had claimed one of the private rooms for her own personal use, and as in so many other things, no one felt secure enough to argue the point with her. She unlocked the door with her own personal key, ushered Brendan in, and then closed and locked the door behind them. The room was bare, save for a functional table and set of chairs. There were no comforts. This was not a room where people lived. It was just a meeting place, somewhere people passed through on their way to their respective destinies. Chantel turned to face Brendan, and the Cardinal bowed low to her.
All goes well so far. The elves are running security so tightly not even a ghost could walk in unchallenged. There will be no interruptions to what we have planned.
We? Don't flatter yourself, Cardinal. These are my plans. Everything that is to happen here happens through my will.
Of course. I mean no challenge to your authority.
Damn right you don't. If I even thought you had a mind of your own, I'd have had you shot and replaced long ago. Now let's keep this short and to the point. I don't want to leave Donna Silvestri in charge of things for too long. She has a good mind, but in the end she's just another Blue Block drone, like you. I need to be on the spot to keep things under control.
Of course, Chantel. Robert and Constance have been separated, as you instructed. They're now stewing in their own juices in separate rooms.
Good. I think it's time they were brought here so I can explain their true place in the real order of things. We'll start with Robert. He has basic Blue Block conditioning. Constance is the real wild card. We can't kill Robert. As one of the 100 hands, he's too valuable to us. But Constance is another matter. If need be, she is expendable.
And that's where I come in.
Kit Summerisle uncoiled lazily from one corner of the room. Cardinal Brendan jumped in shock at not having noticed him, and then tried to look as though he hadn't. Kid Death smiled.
I quite like the idea of killing a queen. I got to chop off the Empress Lionstone's head, but she'd already vacated her body, so that doesn't really count.
You may get your chance. Constance could be very useful to us once she's been properly conditioned, but she poses far too great a threat to Blue Block to be allowed to go on as she is. So, either she bows to Blue Block, one way or another, or you get to do what you do best, Summerisle.
You'd better find me someone to kill soon. I don't want to get rusty.
You'll kill when I tell you to. I own your services now. Blue Block owns you.
Kit Summerisle smiled slowly. and there was no humor in it. Cardinal Brendan fell back a step. Chantelle held her ground, but some of the confidence went out of her face.
A lot of people thought they owned me. Most of them are dead now. I am my own man, and I serve you for my own reasons. I am a killer, and must go where the killing is. But at the end of the day, I'll kill you just as happily as anyone else. I never had your blue block conditioning. My family never approved of you. One of the few things they were right about.
Don't concern yourself, Lord Summerisle. There will be blood and death for you as promised, enough perhaps to sate even your appetite. Blue Block has many enemies, and I will turn you loose on them all in time. Now, you worked for Clan Wolf before the rebellion. Have you ever met Constance Wolf?
We moved in the same circles, nodded to each other in passing. Her late husband Jacob never really approved of me, even as he used me. And his dear wife was always too good and noble to have anything to do with the likes of me. If you're asking if I'll have any problems in killing her, the answer is no. I never have any problems killing anyone, as all the leading members of my late family could tell you. If you had a good medium.